Today on Off Mic, painting the town red, literally, a new public arts program in Gary hopes to turn abandoned structures into works of art, and the issue of child abuse and neglect takes center stage in an online conference today sponsored by IUN in Gary. And the Cubs and Sox are struggling, but they play a big series tonight, all before the playoffs start in this COVID-19 era. All this on Off Mic. Welcome to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. A new public art exhibit hopes to put a colorful splash in Northwest Indiana. Paint Gary features colorful murals on many of Gary's abandoned buildings. Lauren Pacheco is behind the endeavor. She's director of the Public Arts Programming and Engagement at Indiana University Northwest. Lauren, welcome to Off Mic.
Thank you for having me.
Good. So when did Paint Gary actually start as a program?
In 2018, I began a conversation with folks at the City of Gary and the Office of Redevelopment to consider looking at some of the vacant spaces, particularly in the downtown area in Gary, as possible locations for public art opportunities. And so summer of 2018 kicked off by an Argentinian street artist. His name is Nico Escalada, who was actually going to be in Detroit and had an opportunity to come to Chicago and create a mural of some sort. And so we were able to bring him to Gary.
You know, Lauren, let's talk a little bit about your background, because you're a Chicago native, correct?
That's correct. Born and raised on the Southwest side.
And when did you move to Gary?
I moved to Gary 4.5 years ago. My family actually owned some property in Michigan City, so I was familiar with the Northwest Indiana region, and my husband and I at that time decided it was an opportunity to explore other living possibilities. So Gary was on the top of our list.
You know, and a lot of times it takes somebody from the outside to see opportunity where, you know, folks from around here who are here all the time, like me, you may not see the value in doing something. So what was the inspiration when you were, was it driving around and say, you know what? Yeah, that's an abandoned building, but it could be used for so much more.
I had an opportunity to create a series of public art projects in the Pilsen community along the 16th Street Viaduct, which is essentially, you know, just blank wall space. And these are really ripe and wonderful opportunities for public artists to create. But my intention when I moved to the City of Gary was just to buy a home and have that nice separation from my art practice and work in Chicago. But when you drive around the City of Gary, you can't but help but feel a call of action to do some work, right? And when you drive around the City of Gary and you see blank walls and you see derelict buildings, it's really a beautiful opportunity for creatives to have an opportunity to create some type of artwork in that space.
Let me ask you this. How many murals are up in Gary?
To date, we have 59 murals and continue to grow throughout the early fall of this year. And we have about 76 artists, 13 Northwest Indiana artists, and a number of other artists from Chicago. So we have well over 50 murals to date.
And where can we generally find these at around Gary?
So most of the murals are concentrated in the downtown area of Gary. So you're looking at Gateway Park from 2nd Street and Broadway all the way up to 11th and Broadway, primarily around the old Union Station building at Gateway Park, because we have a lot of these retaining highway viaduct walls, which provide really great surfaces. And then they extend a bit off of the Broadway Street onto, for example, the historic Edison houses, which provide really an opportunity for clean, smooth space on the sides of these structures, but also an opportunity to highlight a historic site that is actually on the list for demolition.
Now, when you first started these murals, did you feel like, well, I'm not sure how, if people are going to appreciate this? Has the program turned out maybe even better than you envisioned?
Absolutely, absolutely. I have a number of friends and colleagues who were quite hesitant to come to Gary to visit me, and because they were really struggling with the negative perception that that's out there in terms of Gary around violence and the state of the city in many of its neighborhoods. And I think through public art, through the visual voices that public art production presents in the community, that many people have just really been felt compelled to come and visit the city on their own so that they can build their own impression of the city. And we've had local artists create artworks in the public sphere. We've had global street artists come to the city. It's really been fantastic to see the generosity from curators to independent artists, designers, muralists who really want to leave a creative contribution for the city of Gary, because everyone recognizes the decades-long of disinvestment and blight that the city is facing. And if through one mural, it can inspire people to visit the city, invest in the city, frequent some of the stores, and have a conversation with local residents to change that global perspective that people have of the city, it's really really has changed the way that people see the region. And so I'm quite pleased with it.
Now, I got to imagine some of the murals have certain themes on them. What are some of the more constant themes?
You know, I really want to support the creative process. And oftentimes, artists are compelled to sort of take their own anthropological journey of the city, right? And looking at archival materials found online, having conversations with local residents, and you might find some, local symbol or icon or face integrated into the mural. So there are themes that range from just an artist working in a particular medium in their own practice. Then you might see some public art projects that are facilitated through, say, the steel industry and the immigrant populations that have come through the city in its time, or its sort of architectural impact on the city as well. And so they've taken a whole range from abstract to very conceptual. Two very sort of photorealist with actual faces in the mural itself. So it's really a range of really fantastic pieces.
You know, we're going through so much turbulent times. There's social unrest around the country. Do you know if any of the murals reflect some of the turmoil that's happening in our world?
Absolutely. In August of this summer, an artist named Eric Burke from Reno, he goes by the name Over Under in his street art practice, wanted to create an art piece on the Edison Concept homes in response to the sort of social climate and the social political climate. And it was in response to the civil unrest and some of the racial inequities that have really sort of been bubbling up, right, and the ways in which folks have been protesting. And so the Red Summer of 1919, which was a moment in time when an African American young boy was swimming in a public beach and had floated to the white side of the beach, and that sort of instigated a number of riots in the city of Chicago. And so it was a moment for Eric to create a very large scale conceptual piece that sort of related to that moment in 1919 and reflected in what's happening in contemporary life today. It's a really fantastic piece with sort of beautiful red ochre type colors with a silhouette of a young African-American boy facing north towards the lake. It's really quite powerful on a historic architectural structure that is in really just derelict shape. And it's really sort of calling upon folks to sort of have a moment in an urban environment to sort of stop, pause, and reflect. It's really quite powerful.
You know, what can art do in terms of just telling another story about a community, especially a community like Gary that has has had its ups and downs, has had its, just trying to still kind of find itself. I feel like Gary is just trying to find that one something to kind of reinvent itself. I mean, we do see a casino moving up, and we know politicians look to big things like that that will generate jobs and taxes. But what does art do to tell the story that's happening now?
Sure. I mean, I think most folks can agree that visual voices through public art production could be one way to help shape cities' priorities, say, to strengthen communities that can benefit everyone. And I think public art projects like Paint Gary, there are goals to instigate interactions between public space and people in a world of changing context, right? And quite possibly for the city of Gary, for example, to conceive a new identity, right, through diverse arts practices. Say, Gary reimagining itself as a creative city just 35 miles southeast of the city of Chicago, where it's becoming quite challenging to afford a lifestyle in the city. And might folks consider moving just 35 miles? I keep stressing that because we are just 35 miles southeast of a major metropolitan city, which is incredibly art-rich and incredibly wealthy in many ways, right? But there's an opportunity for the creative sector and through the public arts to help rebuild and reshape a city like Gary that is already known for having such a rich history and role in the way in which culture presented itself in the region. I see public art and Paint Gary as a short-term and a long-term vision for a city to rebuild itself. And so we've got a long way to go because the city lacks access to so many resources through, say, structural inequities or just lack of a strong philanthropic community. So, the goal of public art, in my opinion, is to really, one, beautify communities, highlight the strengths and the people that have remained in the city, highlight the cultural heritage that the city possesses and will continue to showcase, moving forward through stories and conversations. It can play a tremendous role, and we're just one small, I play such a small role in Paint Gary by just securing the walls and securing the materials and having conversations with the necessary people for the permissions. It's really the artists who are really lifting up the city one mural at a time.
Now, there have been more than 70 murals painted already in Gary. How many more do you see coming?
Who knows? As long as I continue to pick up space and receive the permission of the city of Gary through the mayor's office, we will continue to create artworks, whether they are on permanent walls or temporary walls or so many of our surfaces that will come down, unfortunately, because there are some of these buildings that are just in terrible shape. But for a moment, these creative contributions are beautifying the area. So as long as we can continue to find space, I will continue to provide opportunities for muralists to create outdoors in the public sphere. It's a great opportunity for them to add to their own portfolio, to their own profile, and through social media, we're really quite lucky to have a platform that allows folks to virtually visit the city of Gary and maybe plan a visit, an actual physical visit sometime in the future. So we will continue the program as long as we have space to do so.
So obviously, because of COVID-19, you want people to visit a Gary and see it in person, because nothing is like seeing something in person, especially art. But short of that, where can people find some of these murals online or on social media?
Sure. So I have a website called destinationgary.com, and it's an opportunity for folks to explore all of the artist's background, to capture and see images of the artworks already in place. And an opportunity for people to explore some of the other public art projects that are in the city. In addition to Paint Gary, I've created this Gary Public Art Archive and Guide that gives folks an opportunity to explore the city. I don't think very many people know that we have two Richard Hunt sculptures in the downtown area. We've got so many fantastic murals by Hammond artist Felix Maldonado, and the list continues to grow, and it's really a resource for folks to explore the city beyond Paint Gary.
Well, Lauren Pacheco is director of the Public Arts Programming and Engagement at Indiana University Northwest, and she's the force behind Paint Gary. Lauren, thank you so much for being here on Off Mic.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Today, Indiana University Northwest in Gary hosts the 30th Annual Forum on Child Abuse and Neglect. It's a virtual series put on by IUN School of Public and Environmental Affairs. The theme of this year's event is Reframing Child Neglect Due to COVID-19 Restrictions. Joining me to talk about the forum is Richard Hugg, Associate Professor Emeritus at the School of Public and Environmental Affairs. Richard, thank you for joining us here on Off Mic.
Good morning, Mike.
So you were supposed to be speaking today. The event kicked off earlier this morning. We talked a little bit about reframing child neglect. What is specifically the focus of this conference?
Well, specifically, we're talking about, I guess the one of the best ways to describe it is to say that in the past, talking about child abuse and neglect, we've talked a lot about mandated reporters, about the people who are supposed to report what's going on and make sure that children stay safe. The new thinking is that we should really focus on mandated supporters, that there are lots of families out there that need support, and that if we focused more on that, we would be in a better place. We would be more likely to move into the place where abuse and neglect simply doesn't exist, that where families are supported. Neglect particularly, and by the way, the vast majority of children who come into care in most state systems come in because of neglect rather than abuse. And neglect is very closely associated with poverty, and the research suggests that a lot can be done to eliminate, to reduce neglect if we support families. And so the new emphasis in reframing child welfare from a system that basically is a surveillance system with all the resources going to surveillance to one that is a system that is a child and family well-being system, a system that supports families rather than one that is just waiting to pick kids up and move them into foster care. Today's speaker, Jerry Milner, who's the commissioner of the Children's Bureau, has been a leading advocate for this particular point of view. And one of the things that I was reading, looking at some of the things he's written before, and it pretty well characterizes, at least for me, what the whole point of the movement is. He talks about the situation where we had, years ago, we had 50,000 automobile deaths from car crashes. And what he said is in order to reduce that, we didn't invest in the jaws of life, you know, so that there would be a jaws of life unit every 5 miles on the highway. We focused instead on seatbelts and airbags and getting people to wear their seatbelts, and that was obviously much more effective than any approach to make sure that people get out of their crashed cars 20 minutes earlier. So basically he is talking, which is in some ways a fairly radical idea, that we put our resources, that we move resources into the seatbelt idea as opposed to the jaws of life idea. And the seatbelt idea means supporting families. It means helping, making sure that all families have the kinds of incomes that they need to have a thriving family, five thriving children. So that's sort of the theme, to reframe child welfare. And Jerry Milner, the keynote speaker this morning, one of our two keynote speakers, is particularly associated with that particular theme.
Now, Richard, you talk about, you know, the theme about strengthening families at this time, but it must be the most difficult time to strengthen families given COVID-19, given that there's been so many layoffs, people are losing jobs or furloughed. There's a lot of stress right now in households all over the country, and I got to bet in Northwest Indiana too. Does this put children who are already facing neglect or in troubled households even in more peril?
I think that is the case, and we have a session that's particularly devoted to that. We have we're fortunate enough to have this year a speaker who recently relocated to our area. She's a former Detroit police officer, and she was in the community policing units and that sort of thing, and her specialty was restorative justice. And in restorative justice, you get victims and offenders together, and they work out the issues. Well, she's taken the restorative justice approach, and social workers basically call it the restorative approach. And what they do there is they, rather than exact punishment, they encourage families and children to work together to restore and repair relationships. So she uses that particular approach. The restorative approach to all of the things, and one of the things that she is focusing on in our second series, or we have a series of workshops that follow today. Today is the plenary, and she will be speaking in the plenary, but she will also be speaking next Friday. And what she will be talking about there is using her restorative approach to deal with what social workers call situational crisis. And COVID-19 is the situational crisis, and she has a series of tools in her toolbox, in the restorative approach toolbox, that will help families deal with the situational crisis that is COVID-19. It's a situational crisis. The definition is that individuals' coping mechanisms are affected by some sort of situation other than mental illness. So we're talking about, obviously, this is particularly difficult to those who have mental health problems, but for everyone, it's a difficult time. And she has a toolkit that she will be talking about, and that will be next Friday at 9:00.
What are we, Richard? What are your concerns right now? We do know that in the state of Indiana, there's been issues with the Department of Children and Family Services with cuts, with in the past with workers or caseworkers either or moving on, high turnover rate. What is your main concerns right now? As we're in this COVID-19 era. Are children really being focused on? It must be incredibly more difficult during this era.
I think it is more difficult. I think it's the one of the toughest jobs. Our forum started in what we called Public Service Week many years ago, where we honored public servants. And one of the most difficult jobs in all the world, in my opinion, is the job of the worker who must go and investigate to make the very difficult decision whether to move a child from his or her family. And yes, that situation is a lot worse now. Families are more stressed. They're more likely to be problems of abuse and neglect because of the very stressful situation. And yet, one of the things also is that the normal, I mentioned mandated reporters, the normal mandated reporters don't have contact with children. So there is a surveillance problem, and the prevention agencies are asking other people to become reporters. And while the long-term answer is to really support families in place, and that will be very difficult, the short-term answer is we do need the surveillance system to expand. So folks who are normally not part of the surveillance system need to be aware and to be of situations that are difficult and hopefully can get workers into work with families who are experiencing particularly bad stress now and help them deal with their problems and avoid having their children removed from their home.
And in this case, when you use the term, you want people to become reporters. We're not talking about journalists, but we're talking about people who'd actually call the authorities in case they suspect child abuse or neglect.
Right. Most most states have laws of mandated reporters, which teachers and others that come into contact with children, that they are required to report abuse and neglect, and it's very serious, and there are penalties if they don't, that sort of thing. Most states have those rules, and the idea is that I guess the message of our conference would be, yes, you should be a mandated reporter, but you should also be a mandated supporter of families. And the idea is to help families thrive. Parents want their children to do well. Children want to stay with their families, and that is if we all worked with that particular point of view, with that goal of supporting families, supporting parents, we would be in a better place than we are right now.
You know, and the great thing about this very important conference is that welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. You may also know me as a reporter with WBEZ in Chicago. Well, COVID-19 has really wrecked a lot of events this year, including events for Hispanic Heritage Month, which we are in. Because so many events had to be postponed, I decided to air a feature from last year, an event for Dia de los Muertos at Purdue University Northwest, to give you a little taste of Hispanic Heritage Month. Enjoy.
Rachel Pollack.
I'm Elizabeth Rodriguez. We work in the College of Humanities, Education, and Social Sciences, and I'm the assistant to the dean, who is Elaine Carey.
So tell me about this great Dia de los Muertos event. What is it about, and who came up with the idea?
We wanted to do something during Hispanic Heritage Month. And then, you know, this kind of comes right after that, and so we just thought, you know, why not do something Day of the Dead?
So what's all involved here tonight?
Well, we have obviously the mariachi band, which you are hearing. We had some face painting. We had some student groups come in and create altars. And we had our one of our professors from our World Languages office come in and give just some detail about what the altars meant to the student groups and what they represent. We also had cookie painting for smaller kids, obviously the face painting, which some of us adults are enjoying.
I still need to get over and get mine done.
Yeah. And so we're just really excited that the community around us has really come in and enjoyed this event, which, you know, was supported by our chancellor's office as well with building community through the arts. So we've really tried to reach out to the Hispanic community, and we saw really great results this evening.
Well, is this the first time you've had something like this?
We've had several events, but we've done poetry slams here. Rachel is probably a little more familiar with all the different events we've had.
I would say the closest event to something like this that we've done, back in 2016, we did a Fiesta Latina that was around Cinco de Mayo or so. But we haven't done anything like this really involving the Hispanic community in a few years. So we really, like I was saying, with us becoming an emerging Hispanic-serving institution, we really wanted to reach out to those, you know, external communities that we serve and you know, have an event that we could really celebrate and bring in the families and things like that. So this is the first time in a while that we've done something like that. Like Liz was mentioning, we've really been doing the poetry slams during Black History Month.
What have you learned about Dia de los Muertos?
I learned that it's not a sad event. I've learned that it's really about honoring and being respectful and joyous and carrying on those lives, you know, that have been lost into the future, and just really holding them close to your heart and celebrating them. And I've also learned that the one singer in the mariachi band, who happens to be our student worker, her name is Martha Gallegos, has got an amazing voice, so I'm so excited about that too.
She's a beautiful singer.
Yes.
you think this works well in tandem with, say, the American tradition of Halloween?
I think it gives a nice little offset balance, maybe a different perspective. So, yes, but different.
Right, because it's two totally different takes on it, right?
Right.
Because like Liz was saying, this really is like a celebration. You know, it's like a celebration. It's also honoring the dead, you know. It's like it's a celebration of their life, too, you know.
All right. I think that's all I have, but is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I really appreciate you coming out, and I just want to acknowledge, again, Chancellor Keon and Dean Elaine Carey for being extremely supportive to our ideas and supporting these events.
My name is Yvonne Postelmans.
What makes Dia de los Muertos so special for you?
Well, actually, that's a long story, but the fact is that I'm a first generation here in the United States. So we were never taught the Dia de los Muertos for us, but we had seen it a lot with other families. Mm-hmm. And so to us, we found out that Dia de los Muertos was when we actually remember our loved ones. The biggest thing that helped me out was Coco. The movie Disney Coco. That really helped me out in knowing what exactly what the Dia de los Muertos was. For us, having pictures of our loved ones in an altar with their favorite foods and flowers and colors is the number one thing that we would like to do, is to share that with others, that when it's a day like this, it's everybody should share in all the cultures.
And how does it, is it on a specific one day? Is it Friday or is it like several days?
To us, it's several days, because what I'm finding out that here in the United States, since we just don't have like in Mexico a Saturday or Friday, mm-hmm. Here we try to structure it whatever day that we have open. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's the good part about it. So to us, we're doing it on Sunday. Some people do it on Saturday and some people do it on Friday. I believe Friday is the day of the children, you know, and this is when families go to the cemeteries and decorate and clean the tombs and things like that, and put flowers and pictures and food and things like that. Unfortunately, we can't do that here in the United States, mm-hmm. but in Mexico, it's known. In fact, one of my friends went to Oaxaca, and she said it was the most beautiful event she's ever seen.
So what, if you were to ask somebody, like, what's the difference between Dia de los Muertos and, say, Halloween?
Well, Dia de los Muertos, everybody really enjoys that. It's a day that everybody can color their faces, families get together, actually make an altar. Halloween pretty much is like everybody in scary costumes going after you. And it's just about candy. You know, really there's no significance behind it. I mean, I love Halloween. I love giving candy to kids. But I think Dia de los Muertos is a little bit more richer in culture and should be shared with the community.
You think more non-Mexicans are going to start to gravitate towards Dia de los Muertos?
I think they are. I think they are. A lot of my non-Hispanic friends have been looking at this. In fact, going to another country to actually see how it's done, I mean, they kind of miss that here. And I think that Dia de los Muertos is going to become bigger and bigger and bigger. And we're going to be having more events like this.
My name is Rosalia Leal. And I am I'm originally raised in Chicago.
I asked Rosalia, tell me more about the alteras, the altars, and the ofrendas, the offerings that you put on the altars.
First of all, it's your family, your friends that you want to remember, that you want them to come back and see that you are honoring their memory. There's food, their favorite food, favorite toys, favorite hobbies, religious articles. There's a lot of things like the flowers, the marigolds. The marigolds are very important because each offering signifies something. You need a lot of marigolds. You need an arch. You need a cross. You need water to quench their thirst. You need their foods. What else? You need salt. you need...
What's the salt for?
The salt is signifies purity of their soul or something. So it's like as they come back that day, you know, in spirit, there's the water, the salt. Everything is has to do with just purifying and giving them energy and stuff like that. Yeah, so there's a very good... I read about it, but I can't remember each and every thing. And I'm going to do cards on my altar to show what every single person, the thing, like flowers, water, salt, incense, too, from, you know, dust in a form of a cross. Yeah, there's a lot of little things that go in the making, and they all have some kind of significance.
Well, tell me about Sunday. What's happening Sunday?
So Sunday, basically, the Day of the Dead is celebrated on the 1st and 2nd. It starts from the 31st to the 1st and then into the 2nd, from All Saints Day to All Saints Days to All Souls Days. And so in those 2 days, that's when supposedly the spirits and come back and you sell and you're waiting for them in a very spiritual way with all these offerings. So a lot of times the altars are made at homes on those 2 days, or they're made a big celebration in the graveyards. So in their graveyards, they bring sometimes the food and the music, like mariachi and bands and whatever favorite music of that person, they come and serenade at the graveyard site. So it's a big feast of celebration, and it's different where we here celebrate Halloween as a fearful day. In our tradition, it's more the Day of the Dead. It's more of a celebration of life and spirit and so on.
Are you happy that it's catching on a lot more in the United States?
You know, there's a lot more awareness, and I think because of the movies that have come around with Disney and the diversity with, different celebrations and different holidays, I think that has brought more awareness, because before you wouldn't see the costumes of the Katrina and the Katrine and the face painting and all that stuff, because that was very popular always in Mexico, but in here it wasn't much celebrated. So now I think it's a big thing. Now I think it's more aware, the awareness of that date. Here, I think, you're seeing a lot more celebrations, just like the Cinco de Mayo has exploded.
And we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente, reporter with WBEZ. The Cubs and Sox are nearing the end of this COVID-19 shortened season. While both teams have given us great moments, they are both struggling heading into this weekend's matchup. And joining us to talk about tonight's big matchup between the Sox and the Cubs is veteran WBEZ sports reporter Cheryl Raystout. Hey, Cheryl, welcome to Off Mic again.
Thank you, Michael.
Good.
How are you doing?
Fantastic. Well, tonight is the big series between the Cubs and the White Sox, and it's leading off before the playoffs. How significant is this series?
This series is significant for both teams. They're trying to close out and possibly have a division championship too going into the postseason. Now, the Cubs had a better chance of it than the White Sox, but both of them have an opportunity. And you want to start playing well before the postseason. And both teams have struggled so much offensively of late, so they probably want to get their hitting shoes back on before they start, playing a best-of-three-game series starting next week.
Now, both teams have been struggling as of late. The White Sox lost four in a row this week. The Cubs are scuffling a little bit this week as well, losing yesterday. Right now, it looks like, at least for the White Sox, their troubles is with their young rookie star, Luis Robert. What's going on with Luis?
Yeah, Ricky Renteria talked a lot about that before the game yesterday. In fact, he did not start him in that game, mainly because the kid is struggling. And this is something Luis Robert hadn't done in the minor leagues. And so it's just a matter of when you're that young, you've got to be able to learn how to adjust. And all the other – the pitchers have adjusted to him. Now he's got to make the adjustments back, and that's something he hasn't figured out yet. So they're resting him a bit. Even though it's only 60 games, it's been really stressful 60 games for a lot of these players. And so right now they're feeling the crunch. You also have a young White Sox team that have some veterans that have been to the postseason. But when you look 1 through 9 and also the pitching rotation, there's not a lot of experience there. So they're feeling I think they're feeling a bit of the pressure of going into the postseason, even though they clinched a spot. But right now, they really want to win these games because it's really important for the long run.
Yes, with Luis Robert, right, he only has 60 games. And usually for a rookie, no matter how good they are, they usually start off pretty hot, taper off a little bit because the pitchers have adjusted to him. And then you still have a third of the season left to regroup and regain some of that momentum you had early on. And that is that learning adjustment. While he dominated minor league pitching, Major League pitching is the best in the world, and it's going to be tough on someone like him.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is, because of the way this set up with this schedule, there's familiarity. In other words, they're seeing these. You know, they're seeing the teams that they know, that know the White Sox well, and vice versa. So it's a matter of, okay, who's going to have the upper hand? And frankly, the White Sox, they have trouble with Cleveland because Cleveland's pitching is just outstanding. And the Cleveland has hit better now. And somebody like Luis Robert was really getting, you know, he was really getting twisted around. He could not, he wasn't making good contact. And so when you see that as a manager like Ricky Renteria has, you got to sit him down. And you hate doing that, but what Ricky also said is that he could sit in the dugout and he can actually learn. Sometimes it does help. Just get away from it, you know. But the problem is you don't have a whole lot of time to correct what he has to have corrected, because he's going to be important if they want to make any surge beyond the first series.
But do you think with the White Sox, in some ways, just making it to the playoffs is validation that this rebuild has worked? And in future years, yes, maybe. But I know they want to go deep into the playoffs. And some people, of course, like me, White Sox fans, want them to win it all. But I see this as a tremendous step for progress.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is a big deal for them. No matter what, you have to be able to get into the playoffs to understand what it's like to be in the playoffs. And for this team, a lot of people didn't expect them to play this well as they have all, you know, most of the season. But the thing is, the players thought, when we talked to them in January during the media socials, way back when, before everything in the pandemic and everything, these young men were talking about playoffs. They were talking about the postseason. So they felt like they could. But I think the fans and a lot of people were a little reticent about it. And of course, you would be, because you don't know what you're going to have here. That said, they do have an opportunity, because the first series is the best of three. And they're going to have Lucas Giolito pitch game one, Dallas Keuchel's going to pitch game two. So if they can have outstanding, you know, starts, and if the hitting can come, they could win that first series. And that would be a nice feather underneath their cap to go on.
And now the Cubs have been struggling a little bit. You know, it's kind of funny this year. Maybe it's just because my focus has been on the White Sox, being a fan of the White Sox. But it just seems like the Sox have, in this year, have taken the spotlight away from the Cubs. Mm-hmm. But the Cubs are a veteran and still a very dangerous, talented team, and they could go all the way. But as of late, they've been having their struggles.
Yeah, they have not been able to hit. And it's, you know, Chris Bryant has got another injury. That guy is really, he tried to play, and his injury is really, you take him out of the lineup no matter how he's struggling, but he's an important piece to him. Anthony Rizzo has been struggling. You know, we talked to Javi Baez, and he's been struggling. So when you try to figure out, well, what's different? Well, a couple of things have come up over the last several weeks. And one thing that Javi Baez was very honest about this, and I haven't heard any other player talk about, not having the video during the game because of the Houston Astros. Javi Baez, like several players like to do, in between their at-bats, they would like to go into the video room, see what they do to make the adjustment. And that is effective. And apparently, when you look at a lot of these primetime players that are not hitting the way they should, that is a factor. And so you have that going on. The other thing that is, the thing is for with some players and the Cubs are pretty, you know, with Javi and a couple other guys, they love to have the audience. They love to have the fans and they feed off of it. And I think that's affecting some players. Javi's, you know, it's been mentioned with him and everyone keeps poo-pooing it. But I think indirectly it's an issue because, yeah, you could scream and yell in the dugout, but you don't have the fans there. And that makes a difference. And that could be why the White Sox have had some success because, you know, they don't know how it's supposed to be when you're winning.
That's true. That's true. I was going to ask you that. I mean, these players must be feeling something like, yeah, you go to the ballpark and you win and everything, but you don't feel that adulation. I'm sure they hear it on Twitter and they see it everywhere. Maybe they get cheers when they're driving home or something. But at the same time, that you want to see a filled ballpark. And unfortunately this year for all of baseball, all of sports, they just don't have that. And they feed off of that.
They absolutely do. Baseball is one of those things where home field advantage is really something that they enjoy. And, you know, not just a field dimensions, but you know, the roar of the crowd really helps them. And especially for the Cubs, you're talking about Wrigley Field that's used to having a filled house. And think about it, with the players that won the World Series, the ones that are left, they know what that place has been like. And so not to have that has to really be a bother because, you know, that feeds into them. For the White Sox, because they haven't had a filled stadium either, maybe that's, again, why it's worked for them.
That's right. But you know what? For a lot of people who may not realize it, they might think, well, the playoff games are going to be played in Chicago and a possible World Series. That's not going to happen this year, right, Cheryl?
No, it's not going to happen. The first series will be at home if you've won your division. If you're the top four teams will be able to play at home because there's 16 teams in the postseason this year instead of the usual 10. So the first series will be best of three. And both the White Sox and Cubs, depending on how they finish the season, will be playing at home. So that would be good. That'd be good for them. And then after that, the American League will, the ALDS and the ALCS will be playing in California, and the NLDS and the NLCS will be playing in Texas. And then the World Series will definitely be playing at the new Rangers Stadium. So there will be no baseball beyond next week in Chicago.
Wow. Okay, well, moving on a little bit to other sports. The Chicago Bears are 2-0, but it seems like a soft 2-0 that, you know, but you know, 2-0 is 2-0. How is our young Mitch Trubisky, how's he dealing with the success and some of the drawbacks?
Well, the thing is, he knows that he hasn't put together four quarters. In the first game, he had a great great fourth quarter when he had the three touchdowns. And then last week, he had a great first half. That's where they scored all their points. And he was so-so the second half. One of the things that we've seen differently with this Bears team is that they are running the ball more, something that a lot of people didn't like what Matt Nagy wasn't doing. And so they are running the ball more. They're having some success. But Mitchell Trubisky is better than he was. He's not stellar, but he's better. And that's an improvement. The defense also has to really, you know, start honing in a little bit more. But, Michael, the thing is we have to remember with football, they've had limited training camp and no preseason games. So this basically these first few weeks is still trying to get your feet wet and trying to, you know, you want to get those wins, but you want to keep improving. So if he can keep improving and get wins, that would be important. But facing Atlanta, a team that scores a lot of points, it's going to be really interesting to see if the Bears can match them with points or if the defense can really get a stranglehold on the Falcons.
Why is it that fans forget about that they know that there wasn't a preseason game? They act like players should just come out gangbusters, and it's difficult to do that.
Absolutely. And the other thing is you don't do really tough tackling even in these training camps. So that's why you may see more points because the tackling is better than I thought it would be, but it's still not great. And also, Michael, there's been a lot of injuries. There's a lot of players that we're watching, you know, Saquon Barkley. he got an ACL injury last week here at Soldier Field. So, you know, we were seeing a stack of injuries. We're seeing, you know, play starting, you know, mold a little bit, but it isn't easy. That's a tough game. And again, when we talk about COVID, they're all stressed over the COVID thing too. And I know fans don't go, oh, what's the big deal? It's very stressful for them because they take these tests every day, hoping that they don't have anything. And if they do, what happens? So that's always going to be on their mind. So that's part of the game that's not talked about, I think, enough.
And lastly, the Chicago Bulls hired a new coach, Billy Donovan. What's the lowdown on him?
The interesting thing with Billy Donovan, he parted ways with OKC Thunder, and it was only within 2 days that Arturas got a hold of him to say, hey, we want to talk to him. And they had a long 5-hour phone call and meeting. Arturas went to meet him with Mark Everly, the general manager. And so the three of them have talked a lot. Then Billy Donovan had meetings on the phone with Jerry Reinsdorf and Michael Reinsdorf. He's not in Chicago. So it's kind of an interesting thing is the Bulls right now are at the training facility because the non-bubble teams were allowed to do that until October 6th. So he's at home in Florida, you know, conversing with the front office and he's contacting players by text and trying to meet and talk to him. But we're talking about the first time since Scott Skiles that the Bulls have hired a head coach with experience. And I think that's really important because he's also a head coach with OKC and also with the University of Florida. He won 2 championships. And remember, Joakim Noah was with him down there, where he is a player development head coach that also has got very good communication skills. So there's a lot of good things about it. Some people may say, oh, well, he's never won anything big in the NBA. I think with this particular team at this particular time, I think it's a good hire.
And Cheryl, of course, the big news this week also was the passing of the great Gale Sayers. What do you remember about him?
I'm one of the fortunate people that actually watched Gale Sayers play live. And you're talking about a player that was so graceful and can just make everybody miss him. He only played 68 games because he had such bad knee injuries, yet in those 68 games, he was a highlight film every time he had the ball. And if it was medical science was better then, he probably would have had a longer career. But even in those 68 games, he proved that he was a Hall of Famer, the youngest Hall of Famer ever elected to the Pro Football Hall of Fame at 34 years old. He was a gracious man, did a lot of work, charity work for Chicago, Better Boys Foundation, a group in Austin area. He did after-school programs. He was somebody that was more than just a football player to Chicago Bears fans.
Well, that's veteran WBEZ sports reporter Cheryl Ray Stiles. Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us here again on Off Mic.
You're always welcome.
And that is all the time we have for today's program. I'd like to thank all my guests and my producers, Dee Dotson, Jose Rodriguez, Tom Maloney, and my student intern producer from Calumet College of St. Joseph, Emily Gomez. You can hear this program again as a podcast by going to lakeshorepublicradio.org. For me, Michael Puente, thank you for listening and have a nice weekend.